Okay, so these slides are here. Talk to people. You know, that class show, LCA 07.
I'm Lee Bratton, as you probably know. This is my sixth LCA. So I always have a lot of fun. So we're going to cover four main things today. And it says it's a tutorial, but it's 90 minutes, so I don't really have enough time to dig really deeply into everything here. My goal is to give you an idea of things to watch out for and some starting points to go home and play with your own website a little bit. And I'm pretty sure by the end of this talk that you will be pretty anxious to get home and check a few things, both performance-wise and maybe more importantly, security-wise. But the whole point of doing this stuff, building a web application, is to interact with people, is to take your idea and somehow make an electronic version of getting at something. And I've been asked to give various non-technical talks over the past year or so, and giving a lot of keynotes at various conferences. And they don't want to see code. So one of the things that we're talking about at these conferences is a little bit about open source. I went to 25 conferences last year. And someone talked yesterday about, I heard the mail last night talk about LCA being probably the top open source conference there is. I think so. I go to basically all of them. And I really prefer the atmosphere and the attitude here. It's a little bit hard to explain open source to the non-open source folks out there and to folks at non-open source conferences. And one of the things they always ask me is, so why? Why do you give away your stuff? Right? And we're tired of hearing these arguments at open source conferences. So when I try to explain it to people, I break it down into a few things. So a few categories of people. Lots of people do it purely out of self-interest. I started PHP completely out of self-interest. I needed a tool that did this. I didn't like any of the other tools out there, so I built one. And this was in 1995, so there were basically no other tools out there. But most people were using Perl as a CGI, and my web server just couldn't handle forking. I mean, Perl interpreter for every single incoming request. Work. There was no mod curl. There were no decent server-side tools. There was nothing back then. I needed a tool, and that's where PHP came from. So I purely fall into the self-interest category of open source contributors. There are folks that contribute to open source because they want to express themselves. I mean, everybody needs to communicate and interact with other people. We have this very community hormone called oxytocin. And oxytocin is a hormone that gets emitted for women during childbirth, during orgasm, simply talking to other people as well. This oxytocin thing kicks in. Even geeks need oxytocin. And a lot of geeks end up not really talking to a lot of people, at least directly. But oxytocin also comes up when you interact with people online. It's known as a human on the other end. So a lot of folks do it via like World of Warcraft style games, any sort of interactive games where they actually interact with other people. And if you go into some of these things, they're not really playing the game. Right? They're mostly interacting with other people. There's some game components to it. But the real point, and the reason people get so addicted to these things, is the interaction with other people, maybe through points in the game or whatever. But it really is about the interaction. It's not much fun playing a single-player game local. That doesn't get the oxytocin going. And then there are a few really weird folks out there that contribute to open source because they want to improve the world. And so they're nice things to say, I'm improving the world. I would be completely lying if I said that was my goal to contribute to open source. It's a very nice side effect. And I definitely don't want to do anything that wouldn't improve the world. And if that's a side effect of my own self-interest, then great. But I think we're getting ourselves all the while we're only doing this stuff to the developers. This is not true for the most of us. So there's a lot of self-interest going on. There's also a lot of self-expression. Keep writing code and sharing and showing the friends, hey, look at my code. I can do better. Here's my algorithm. There's a lot of that going on where that's really the motivating factor for a lot of folks. So, what does any of this have to do with the website? I think this basic principle of open source projects, and this is something that's true in the PHP project and in most projects, is if you want people to contribute to your project, you can't just put a bunch of code out there and say, look how great I am. This is my great code. Help me or contribute to it. Fix my bug. It'll never work. You basically have to give up complete control and you have to create an environment where people feel good about contributing to the project, where they feel they own the project as well. I mean, PHP is not mine. I mean, it started it, but it's not mine really at all. We have 1,100 people with CBS accounts. Huge group of people working on this. And people feel that they're part of the project. They feel that they own a small part of this project. Again, what the heck does that have to do with websites? I think it has a lot to do with websites. Look at some of these very popular sites out there. I think these operate very much like open source projects. In the early days of the web, websites were more like newspapers, where you basically put some static information on the site, and people would come and read it. They'd come back the next day and say, well, there's nothing new, and it's go away. Right? Publishing a newspaper is a lot of hard work. You have to put out unique content every single day to bring your readers to your site. And it sucks writing a site like that, because you have to continue the updates that you do. Now, what Web 2.0 means and how I tie this into open source is that most of these sites here, and I talk PHP as a project in there as well, they're self-propelling. You create a framework, you create this skeleton of a website, and the user is updated. Flickr, for example, is not a very complicated application. It's a very simple PHP MySQL application that would be absolute crap if it had no users. Right? If there were no photos on Flickr, why would anybody ever photo them? Right? So people go there, and you still get very addicted to Flickr sometimes. Because yeah, you might go and update your photos, then you see the new photos from your friends, and then you see all the new photos, and you start to see other photos in other places. Suddenly you wait for 2 hours clicking around in the Flickr. And that's a good website. I mean, it solves a very nice problem for you. So you contribute to Flickr purely out of self-interest, in the sense that you want to host your photos somewhere so that he doesn't see it. So you're using it and you contribute to Flickr out of self-interest. But by doing so, you are helping the site. You are basically creating content for the site. So the bottom there, systems are trying to network test and get better than the people use them. That's the trick, you say, to building a successful website. Wikipedia would just be an empty wiki with no content at all if users didn't contribute to it, right? YouTube, MySpace, LinkedIn, Amazon, if you go and buy something from Amazon, yes, it's purely self-interest, you buy an item. But whenever you buy an item, you create a data point, and you then, when you go and check some other items, the people who bought this also bought that. That's completely user-generated content, review, all this stuff. Every time you use the site, you make the site better. To me, this is what that tool means. And you hear all kinds of crap about that tool in a stupid term. I really don't like it. But I do see a decent shift from the early days of the web with static HTML pages or a little bit of stuff to these highly interactive sites where every single click on the site improves the site, because that click is reported and correlated to other things on the site. And when you come back the next time, if you have 1,000 clicks in between this business and the next business, those 1,000 clicks make the site different. And I find this extremely interesting, mostly because you don't need to have a newspaper staff of reporters who update the content. Flickr was basically written by two people. there are a few more people in the company, and one of the two people wrote most of the code. It doesn't take a whole lot of resources to build one of these gelatins. You just have to hit that one place where you can cater to someone's self-interest, and you can take that self-interest and use that data. One example I really like of this is a complex camera. I don't know if you guys have seen this. When I first saw it, it was like, whoa, weird. What Flickr is doing is they get all this new data coming in. Everyone uploads photos to Flickr. And in the exit tag for the photos, you can pick out which camera the picture was taken with. So they can track how popular the various digital cameras are simply by running tests on all the uploaded photos. So you can see the percentage of members using a Digital Rebel XT high right now. You can see various trends and various the point and shoot cameras, the SD 400 going down, the SD 600 going up a bit. Which makes a lot of sense because I actually just retired my SD 400 and I got the cheap SD 600, so that matches perfectly my situation. I mean, apparently a lot of other folks are doing the same. But by taking out some of the information, which really isn't interesting to the individual, but in aggregate form, really, really interesting for a lot of people, especially advertisers. And like it or not, a lot of the web is advertising driven. You can pull out a lot of stuff in aggregate form without any real privacy or security issues and get a lot of value out of that. All right. So, basically, this same slide I had told into a project immediately can lead to building a good website. So we'll talk about the technical aspects next to the website. You still have to up front figure out what am I actually doing? How am I building my site? How am I catering to people? And how do I make every click count? And if you do something, then that makes the site better. Because if you're the only person who has access to the thing that's to your site, your site's going to die. If you're going to take a tire of it in a week or a month, you can make it self-propelling. You'll have some. All right. So we've seen plenty of examples of decent ideas that have terrible implementation. There's a popular social networking site, Friendster, for example, right? They caught people's attention. People got excited about it. Lots of people joined the Friendster site. And the more people started using it, the slower and slower and slower and slower the site got. So the point is, sitting there clicking, wondering, network connection drops, you click the anchor again, nothing's happened. One of the surefire ways of getting rid of your users. Your site doesn't work, good luck. Right? And the next guy will copy your idea, implement it correctly, and you learn to do it. So, you want to make sure that doesn't happen to you. And since you're the idiot who wrote the code, you're the wrong idiot to fix it. You knew how to write it correctly, you would have done so in the first place, right? So you either fire yourself, hire somebody smarter, which isn't always possible. For some people, it's very possible, but for others, it's a little hard to find somebody smarter nearby. So you need a tool that's smarter than you. I really, really like Valgrind, and an extension to Valgrind called Tallgrind. I can't write any code without Valgrind anymore. But that's sort of at the C bugging level. What we're interested here for a website is how we can take Tallgrind and apply it to our entire web application. And let me show you that with a very simple example. So I'm going to take a very simple MVC approach to a very simple site. This is a site that just puts up newspaper headlines or article headlines, whatever. It does a query to a database, joins two tables, and puts up a list of articles on the front page. So I have a few pieces to it. I have configuration on my web app, config the link. I have my data model, which connects to my database and issues my SQL query. I have some utility functions, just to add a bit more meat to it. And head the link has my header and footer look and feel pieces. So this is my template, or my view, if you want to speak MVC here. So my view initially puts up the header, the HTML header of my page, calls the article, function that returns a bunch of articles in an array. I loop through them. I uppercase the text just to do a little bit more in my benchmark here. And print out a table, basically. So the table entry for each article. This is called a here doc, the triple less than. So anything inside here. Did you want the light on for this? Can you re-hit that button? Hold on, just leave that aside. Thank you. Are you okay seeing?
No.
Yeah, okay. So inside of your doc, you can put any sort of expression in the variable, and you don't have to escape. As long as you put them inside curly braces, you can put even array, look up some stuff. If you just have simple variables, you don't need to put curly braces around it. That's just a here doc for each article. Then I have another utility function to do a bit more, and my footer. My configuration file, this is create an array, a dollar config array. Then I'm using Postgres, my username, password, where my database is, turn on exception for CDO. My data model, a little bit small, but here's my article function, which creates a new PDO object that passes in from my configuration, my database, server, password, user, whatever. My query selects users' name, user's age, data entry from users from data. So data name is username from if you're looking up in the database for this particular user, which article should I show? And then I send off a query, and this CDO fetch a stock basically says, give me the return an associative array where the column name in the database is the key and then the value. And if there are any errors, I catch those. And I return the result. So that's my very, very simple little data model. My head dummy just has to look and feel, just two functions that just have basically no insight. So my head is dot. In a real site, we have a lot more. You have dot type, you probably have to see it in JavaScript. And a simple footer function. And finally, my utility function, just to have another file with a few more functions called uppers, is uppercase, the string, blue, the print out blue. Alright, so this is my very, very simple little CSP application. I have my Ubuntu box sitting at home, a bit of a slow old CPU, a bit of RAM, decent hard drive thing, running Ubuntu 2.6.15, PHP 5.1, and Postgres 8.1. Probably should rerun it with Postgres 8.2 at some point. It's actually gotten a lot better. But running Postgres 8.1 is a good test. I like using a little tool called HTTP Load. You can pick it up from acme.com, acme.com. And you tell it that you want to send 5 parallel requests, 1,000 fetches, and then you write a text file. And in that text file, you have a list of URLs, one URL per line. And it'll hit those URLs. In this case, it just has my front page in there. It's just one URL. And it comes back and tells me this. 1,000 fetches. 6,000 bytes per connection, 17 requests per second is what we got out of it. But more importantly, the second yellow number here is the milliseconds to first response, also known as the latency, 284 milliseconds. So that's the delay or the time between the request is sent out and the first byte comes back in the response. That's the latency. And 284 milliseconds is absolute crap. This is a seriously broken website. One of the features of PHP is that it's easily scalable. There's nothing in PHP that ties into a single server. So if your boss came to you and said that we need 1,700 requests per second, this is my arbitrary example of possible here. We need to handle 1,700 requests per second. We can top 100 servers at this problem, and we can meet that goal without changing anything. But you can scale all you want. You're still going to have 100 slow servers because each one is going to have 204 millisecond latency. So that's a very obvious difference between scalability and performance, right? Scalability is easy enough in this particular example because you just have a front-end connection to a database. As long as your database can handle those queries, you may have to create a replication tree of MySQL servers if your database server can't handle it. But that's a replication, or that's a scalability problem for the database. DEP tends to kick out the scalability issues to the components that you need to scale for the level that they take. There is no real scalability issues in PHP itself. You'll read a lot about people saying PHP doesn't scale, which makes absolutely no sense, because there's nothing in PHP to scale. Usually what they mean is some component PHP is talking to is not scaling very well. And they attribute that fact to the extreme, but it makes no sense. What they should be talking about is their LDAP server doesn't scale because it's not handling the amount of load that PHP is throwing at it, or whatever it's talking to. PHP itself inherently cannot have scalability issues because it doesn't have anything that relies on anything to work. Fixing this purely by throwing servers at it is not going to work, because we're just going to have 100 servers. We're going to be able to meet the load, but it's going to be a crap experience. When you're benchmarking, you should have a look at what's happening on the server as you're benchmarking. Make sure you're seeing the inbound before you start playing with the code. CPU idle over there, let it be on stat 1. CPU idle is 0. Make sure CPU is K, your CPU down. Anything you do to use less CPU resources is going to improve your situation. So, why is it so bloody slow? I use a call line. Of course, I have a start my call line. Yes, I'm stuck in the stupid Mac. So, I run the install line. -2 equals call grind with a few flags on here, and user estimate Apache -X. The capital X means don't fork, so it just runs a single process. So I run my entire Apache server under valve grind. And what I get out of that one, which is like, run K cache grind on the output file that comes out of your call grind run. Basically start up call grind and you hit the server. You can run your benchmarking tool on it, or you can just web browse with it and hit it a number of times. After you've looked at a few of these call graphs and what it's called, is you'll notice that this thing looks like a stick. That means there's a node really low down in the tree that's taking up a lot of CPU. Each of these nodes, here in these boxes, basically represent the spot in the code in the application and the amount of CPU time spent at that spot and anything that this thing calls. And I've said, you can go in and you can you can set the minimum node count thing. So the minimum amount of CPU that will create a new node, essentially. I forget how to actually do it. I thought it was a record rate. And I set it to 3% in this case. So I don't care about anything that takes less than 3% of my CPU. So as I go down, you'll notice that it drops off a little bit. 99.71, 99.45. So this thing called a few other things, but it used so little CPU that it wasn't a significant piece of the code. So I only care about the significant thing. So the significant thing is standalone main calls. It's called startup children. So then we move to that node. And this node calls a, well, it only calls one thing for us, right? Make child, which calls child main, which calls at process request. So we're still completely in Apache land right now. passengers using 99.29%. Process request, invoke handler, send part PHP. So here's the handoff from Apache into PHP. So maybe 99.35% of our time is spent by PHP or in PHP, and then called by PHP. So when you send PHP, Apache PHP module name, PHP execute script. So 99.06% of our time is spent executing a PHP script, which is good. We sort of expect that. This is all we're doing on our server right now. We're hammering this PHP script running under Apache. So far, everything's fine. If we sort of take a higher level look at our application, you saw what it did. You saw that it's connected to the database, send off a SQL query, and sends it out to the result. Where would you expect the bottleneck to be in that application?
Right.
Which connection?
Yeah,
we all threw a query. But you think the connection is going to be higher than the query?
Yeah, the network up, there should be a limit for the connection in Java.
Okay. You're actually pretty close. Most people guess that it's the SQL query itself, because I'm joining two tables, and that could be the problem. So, as we go down, we can actually see exactly what's happening. So we have this is an off-code handler, basically, inside PHP. Function call by name, so we call the function call helper, blah, blah, blah. We can go down a little bit and we can see which function was actually called. And whenever you see ZIS, so ZIS, PBODBH constructor, ZIS stands for Zend Internal Function. So here we have an internal function being called, and it's the constructor for the PBO object. And so here's what we see that you're completely right. It's connecting to the database. If it's at the constructor level, we're using all our CPU. The SQL query is not even showing up. Because that would have been another leg of this tree or another branch of this tree, but we only have one. So the SQL query is taking less than 3% of our CPU time. It's not significant. All our time is spent connecting to the database in this particular case. And we can go on to now we're in PQConnectDB. So we're not in PHP anymore. We're in the Postgres client library called libpq, and a function called PQConnectDB. 96.34% of the time is spent in libpq connecting to the database. Wow. That sucks. But we can dig deeper. This is why I really like Callgrind. Because any other sort of PHP level profile, anything like that, we stop there. We have no idea what's happening underneath the cover. And what I discovered, and this is my first one, my analogy, I just installed the default Postgres packages on Ubuntu. So if we look down, we'll see, I'm spending 93.21% of my time doing SSL3 send client key exchange. What? I didn't ask for a secure connection, right? But by default, Postgres on Ubuntu, even for localhost connections, will do an encrypted connection. If someone can sniff my localhost connection, I'm screwed. So there's really no point in having an encrypted connection from localhost to localhost. But that happens by default on Ubuntu for some dumb reason. So you simply figure out where your configuration file is. So there's a Postgres SQL.conf file somewhere, and the little thing that says encrypted connection, if it's on, you turn it off, and you rerun your endpoint. So if you rerun it without encryption on the connection, and suddenly our latency, which was 284 milliseconds before, has dropped to 44, and we went from 17 to 108, simply by twiddling one little simple configuration slide somewhere. I'm not sure how you would figure this out without something like Callgrind, right? If you really knew Postgres, it might dawn on you to check that. But a lot of people are like, okay, well, they know enough about the database to issue queries and things, so they sort of rely on the fact that the default integration will do something intelligent for them. In this particular case, it did. In this particular case, it really screwed up. And you might, by asking lots of people, someone might suggest, hey, check that. But this is a way where you can really zero in and find exactly what's going on. So, we fixed that one issue. And we run our benchmark again. So my next one after I've done that is PQConnect. We're
run out of games, and we found that we're still spending about 10%, 9.76% of our time connecting to the database. We can lower that a little bit more by turning on persistent connection. So a persistent connection just means that the database connection is kept up from between the Apache file process and the database server. It stays up across connection. If you're always connected to the database with the same credentials and the same server, that might work. You have to be quite careful about configuring the database and your max client in Apache, which is the maximum number of four children. You want to make sure that the database can handle at least max client plus one connection. Instead of the same number, you may not get in from the command line to do anything, right? Because your Apache children have taken up all your connections. So make sure that your max connections in the database is max client plus one. So we turned on the persistent connection, and we went from, what were we at? 108 requests per second, 44 millisecond latency, and we got to 339 requests per second, 10 millisecond latency. So we've really only done three things. So we've turned off encryption on that connection, and we've turned on persistent connection. And we might have done that. Yeah, we might need 1700 requests per second. We can toss five servers at it, and we've solved the problem. 10 millisecond latency is not bad. If you get down to 10 millisecond latency, you're doing okay. But I'm a bit of a performance freak. And if something says it's going to take five servers, why can't it take four? Right? If I can get it down to four, why not three? So that's me. Now, there's a whole bunch of reasons not to use MySQL for certain things, and a whole bunch of reasons to use Postgres. There's also like one or two reasons to use MySQL for something, and the main one is bloody fast at connecting. The Postgres model is fork a child for every new connection. And there's some overhead, even if the child is already forked, there's some overhead kicking up a query in it. MySQL's main thing it has is that piece of the code is amazingly streamlined. You can actually do persistent MySQL or non-persistent MySQL connections faster than you do persistent Postgres connections. It sucks because I think Postgres is a better database, but the connection handling is startup cost in it. If you can fit your problem into what MySQL can handle, then from a performance perspective, you should have a serious look to see what it actually means for your numbers. Many times you can't fit it into what MySQL can handle. Many times 339 requests per second is probably fast enough. So here, there were those two numbers. We were at 339 requests per second with Postgres in persistent connection mode. MySQL without persistent connection between 370 for this particular example. I turn on persistent connection for MySQL, I get 5.5 requests per second. So 339 to 5.5, it's a decent jump. So some people say, well, you're using MySQL query cache because you keep sending the same query over and over. You're hitting the query cache, which in the real-world application doesn't really reflect what's happening. I'm actually not using the query cache, even though it's turned on. Because of some stupidity inside MySQL, it's not being used. In call grind, you can go through and see that I'm doing a prepare execute from TDO. And that calls these two internal functions in the MySQL API. MySQL handle prepare and MySQL statement execute. If you do a prepare execute using the native API of MySQL, it will not use the query cache. Even if you send the same damn query over and over and over again, if you prepare it, it'll miss the query cache. There's no technical good reason for that. That's just the way it is. Basically, it was. So, one way around it is to not use prepare execute and simply use one of the direct MySQL APIs, like the MySQL extension or the MySQL I extension. Or you can still use TDO, and you can still get some of the benefits of prepare execute by escaping the value of the family by turning on this attribute emulate prepare. A bit like DBI and Perl can emulate prepare execute, TDO can also emulate prepare execute for databases that don't have it.
And even with databases that have it, you can override the database version and do it at the PDO level if the database happens to be stuck at it. So this jumps us up to 580 requests per second. We need 1700, we only need 3 servers now. So, a little bit better. And in this case, we didn't have to change that much. We just had to change a few things in our configuration file to turn on the errors. Now, the next big jump you can get comes from an opcode cache. An opcode cache sits between the two stages of PHP. The first stage reads the script from the disk and turns it into a set of opcodes. And the second stage is an executable. It takes those opcodes and executes them, and executes the result. An opcode cache sits in between that and caches the opcodes generated by the compiler and stores those opcodes in shared memory. So on the second request for the same script, you don't have to read from this and compile, you just read from shared memory. At the action point, you execute it right to shared memory. I think the pal just walked in. He's sitting over there. He does most of the work on that side. So in this particular case, when we apply APC, before we apply APC, we see we spend about 37% of our time compiling the file. So basically what APC does, it gets rid of this box completely. And well, it's not completely free. You might reduce the 37% to about 2% or so. Pretty easy to install. It's in TECL. You can do TECL install APC. You get an INI file like this. So you stick it in your php.ini file. The extension is apc.so. Said a few things. The most important piece is the amount of shared memory you want to allocate to APC. And restart the web server, and instead of 580, we're now going 805 requests per second. That's pretty damn good. Now, looking through the call grind, we can dig into some other things. Over on the left side of the call grind output, you'll see the list of functions, the number of times the function is called. Some of the things you can do is you can have a look at which functions are being called a lot. So there's some logic, and then copy obviously gets called a lot. But by looking at that, we can pick out the fact that we saw 20,000 file openings across our 5,000 requests. And when we're using APC, we shouldn't be reading our four scripts, our four includes. We shouldn't be reading them from disk every time. But for some reason, we're opening on every single request. This is because include ones and require ones are not optimal for an upload cache. They basically assume that you're going to be opening the files. They do an fopen instead of just a stat. They do an fopen to then get the stat information to compare to see the terminal list of the files that already been included. It's already included, it will basically ignore that include. That's what the ones mean. That you can only include this file once. So every time you do an include once, you have to check the internal list of included files if this file is already been included. Now, that's very handy. If your code is messy, if you don't know who is including what from where, then just toss an include once in there. You can sort of just be very free about that, which is nice. But from a performance perspective, it sucks. Especially sucks if you actually are including the same file multiple times on one request. And four of these include ones are being ignored and turned into no-ops, basically. There's overhead involved in doing this check. If you can avoid the check, you need to do it. So, if you can get rid of include ones and require ones, you can get a little bit of speed out of this thing. Not a whole lot, but you can get rid of some of the open calls. And it depends how many includes you have. If you're doing a lot of it, this effect would be magnified a bit. It is also possible to turn off that. Instead of APC stat equals zero, this is a check to see if the script on the disk is newer than the cached version of shared memory. It happens on every single request. You can turn that off and basically just leave your web server running against shared memory the whole time. That means you change the file on the disk. It won't be reflected until you restart the server. And you have to have full path includes for this to work, which is a bit of a hassle sometimes. But I sometimes do it like this. We'll get CWD and then just include my path right here on my requires so that as far as PHP is concerned, it sees the whole path. You can still move your scripts around and do things like that. So, again, not a huge thing. Now, I mean, every single thing we do now gives us less and less determined. So, we probably should have stopped except for So I'm sort of taking it as far as we possibly can. Another thing PHP allows you, or HTTP allows you to do, is store some self-insured memory on your own. So in this case, the configuration file is just an array. So I load in my configuration file, and I store it in shared memory, and I give the key and save. And then on the second request in, I can HTTP fetch, it will come back, and it will repopulate my config array right there. So another little piece, about 5 requests per second. We can, of course, also cache our entire SQL query, which isn't always possible with your personal life, but that's another one here where it's possible to do store fetch around my query. It can be. And the final one is, if you can get rid of some include files, you're better off with fewer, larger include files than a lot of small ones. So I took my utilities, the link file, and tossed these two functions into my model.link, and got another 10 requests per second out of it. So, this is the final version of this. We started at 17 requests per second with 284 millisecond latency, and we ended at 1100 requests per second with 3.6 millisecond latency. It shouldn't take more than an hour or two to sort of visually go through these steps. And every time you make an improvement, run the benchmark VMP, where's my bottleneck now, where's my bottleneck now, and get rid of them. I bet you most of you in here have no idea where your bottleneck is. Yeah, especially in the dark there.
I could be wrong, but I think on some of these previous benchmarks, the maximum search response time is lower than the max of what you have there, which is the one with 1,100 seconds, which I'm not saying is bad, it's just worth it to note that if you've got a minimum requirement for that first catch.
No, but this is me, maximum min.
That's right.
You're always going to have some outliers. I mean, there's going to be times when other things are happening on the machine. I mean, you run benchmarks for a long time to sort of even out all this stuff. Right? A Unix machine is not a dedicated process. It just does run your process. It runs other things as well. So something could have happened on that particular request or something else doing something. Those outliers, you sort of have to ignore. If there are a lot of them, your mean is going to slow down. Right?
Yeah.
So I wouldn't worry too much about that max.
I suppose within there, they're not rigid numbers, but there is some fuzz around them. So
Of course there's fuzz around them. And I mean, I didn't run that many requests. I mean, you probably should run more. I only ran 15,000 requests. The data is going to be a little bit noisy. You're going to need to run longer and run more of an average than out. So I wouldn't put too much emphasis on an outlier in those numbers. And if I run this one 10 times, that max number is going to be all over the map. One thing to make sure of, make sure it says code 200 at the bottom. If it says code 404, 15,000. All right, I was asked to take a break so we can swap tape up there. So how about, we don't have time, 5 minutes break?